The original guide to men's health is moving to a monthly release schedule. We will be releasing new episodes the first Wednesday of each month. We really appreciate you listening, and we hope you enjoy this episode. Whatever you do, whatever you enjoy, you need your health. Welcome to The Original Guide to Men's Health, a podcast designed for men of all ages to learn about and access good health. This guide shares knowledge on how to be and stay healthy, maintenance and prevention strategies, along with reviews of conditions and issues affecting wellness are explored. Please join me, your host, Dr. Richard Pellman, as I interview renowned experts who will provide you with timely, relevant, and vital information so that you can embark on a journey towards better health. On this episode of The Original Guide to Men's Health, we'll be exploring dermatological conditions. We'll be talking about some common conditions. We'll be talking about aging of the skin, prevention, skin cancers. We'll also be talking about hair loss, male pattern baldness, nail issues, and ultimately we'll also talk a little bit about cosmetics in the field. To guide us along, we're delighted to have Dr. Kendra Bergstrom with us. Dr. Bergstrom is a board-certified dermatologist at the University of Washington. She's actually a Seattle native. She graduated from UC Berkeley, undergraduate, went to medical school at Stanford, had her internship at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, and her residency at the Perelman Department of Dermatology. Dr. Bergstrom has a significant experience in dermatology. She practiced in New York. She's practiced in the private world and now with the University of Washington. She is board certified in dermatology. She was recently again noted as one of Seattle's top doctors, and we are thrilled to have her join us. Welcome, Dr. Bergstrom.
Thank you, Dr. Frohman. It's great to be here.
I thought we would start, first of all, with the fact that skin is one of the common organ systems. We don't think of it as such, but it certainly is important. And just talk about skincare from teenage or birth on. How would you advise somebody to look after their skin, just as maintenance?
That's a great question. There's a lot of marketing of soaps and things like this, but really the key is to tailor it to where we are at a certain point in our life. Young people don't get very sweaty until puberty, then they start needing a lot of soap. And that maybe is the sweatiest and the oiliest we're going to be. And then as years continue, we make less and less oil. And we find that a lot of those routines we had are a little too harsh. We're ready to use a little less soap, a little more moisturizer. And it's nice to not think that we always need more soap just because it's there. And sometimes less is more.
So there are more astringent soap, deodorant soaps versus, I remember most dermatologists say Dove is the purest soap. And what kind of soap is good there, and move on?
Yeah, for active, sweaty people, definitely. Those antibacterial soaps, the Dials, the Irish Springs, really do a good job keeping the bacteria down. And that's what makes our sweat smell bad. And that's something we all like to avoid, especially in armpits and sweaty spots, groin. We're going to need more soap as we're young and active. However, if the person has dry skin or a person is not so sweaty or working inside or somewhere cold, they may not need that much soap. And instead, we go to a real simple soap, including Dove, including Purpose Basis. There's lots of brands, but sometimes that antibacterial soap can get a little harsh.
And moisturizers, when would you say putting something on skin?
Yeah, you know, I talk to a lot of guys who don't love lotions and creams. They feel sticky, they feel slimy. It's not the best fix with body hair. I think of our skin like a thermostat. We want to get not too oily, not too dry, just right. So I see folks stripping off their natural oil with soap and then putting on new oil from the store. That sounds kind of tiring. So I say, hey, if you're dry, put soap or you're sweaty, rinse off with tap water, the rest of it. And that way you'll kind of save yourself a little bit of time and energy and hopefully keep your skin moisturized that way.
Are there some environments, you know, we're in the Pacific Northwest, inside a lot, very hot now, but typically we're in a moist environment, you know, that versus somebody in a more arid place like Arizona, Southern California, Florida, New Mexico? What would you advise somebody in those climates?
No, you're absolutely right. The dry interior climates, the low humidity is really tough on our skin and we need more moisture. See how sneaky, because even when it's rainy outside, the forest air heat comes on, the radiant heat comes on, and it gets dry in our house. So even though it's wet, it's not humid as if we were, say, in Florida or somewhere on the East Coast. People find they need a little less soap here. And then I think if they do hop over to, say, Colorado, Utah, up at altitude, it's pretty dry climate and we find we need a little more moisturizer and a little less scrubbing.
As we age, what would you say as far as skincare?
Most people as we get older see our skin getting drier. It's real gradual, but it just happens. And if you study people's oil glands, we make the most oil we ever did at age, 14 or 16. And every year we just make a little less. So that soap that stripped off all that oil, we may need less of it. And we might just keep it simple with either tap water or Robland soap with just our hands.
Well, let's take a look at some of the common dermatological conditions. I think for a starter, having acne is very common. Why don't you kind of address that as a common condition?
Acne, it's not a disease so much as a phase. 85% of people go through it. And for men in particular, there's a lot of challenge about having acne on the body, chest and back, and acne that gets a little bit more cystic and deep and can leave scarring. Guys have a final challenge because they're not hiding it. They're not using any sort of cover-up. So it's very face forward. And I think it's really important to be aggressive to keep these young men looking their best and not scarring.
Kind of looking at it as a way of making the best of it while it's a phase, particularly if it's in areas that are showing. What do you advise? A young man comes in and somewhat embarrassed by it. What do you tell him?
Oh, for sure. So starting with the simple step, it's really important to wash off our oily spots. And if we get busy, washing our face at night is the most important. During the day, we get sweaty, we touch things. It's good to get that oil off. Whereas in the morning, we've just been sleeping in our bed. So if we get busy, that's a better one to skip. Since we're already washing and we're already showering, just grab one of those anti-acne washes, salicylic benzoyl, big bottle, doesn't have to be expensive. And if you scrub that on the oily areas, that'll help keep it in check.
And then as far as more severe cases, there used to be antibiotics. Still in favor?
That's the great question. So the next step is the topical vitamin A retinoids, and kind of exciting and making people's lives easier. One is over the counter now. It's called Differin or Dapalene 0.1% gel, but basically you can pick it up at the drugstore. You put a thin layer all over the breakouts at bedtime, even on the chest, even on the back, and it's going to shrink down those pores in a month or two.
Then oral antibiotics still, no?
Absolutely. And for those big, deep cyst ones, we do want to be more aggressive. They're not comfortable. They're painful and they can scar. So antibiotics are a great sprinter. They shut things down quickly. We want to use them for a month or two. But when people start using an antibiotic for over 6 months, we start worrying. Could it affect your gut? Could you have an allergy? And for those folks, I might consider what I call the nuclear option, and that's the isotretinoin or Accutane.
Okay. And for people who are starting to become comfortable with their breakout, primary care doc, family doc, and dermatology would be the resources to go see, because there are things to do. And it helps.
Yeah, we're all on the same team. And I think anyone who sees a lot of teens will have a lot of great tools to get things started.
I should say pediatricians too, as teens sometimes continue on with their pediatricians. Somebody you know, somebody you trust, and they'll help. And then typically, what age do most people move through the phase where it's gone?
If we could say to you, hey, this is going to be gone at age 18 or 22, or stick around till 30, we'd have a really good predictor of who we could use. Right now, it's hard to tell. So the best guess is check with your parents, check with your siblings, see, hey, what happened with them? And that's probably the most likely. But of course, we're all our own person. So there's a little bit of variation in there.
Let's move to eczema or atopic dermatitis. Explain a little bit what that is and what happens and how it shows up and what we do about it.
Atopic dermatitis is a word for eczema that comes from the inside, and it's actually becoming more and more common. It's part of this allergic triad where people have asthma and the eczema, atopic dermatitis, and they have hay fever too. They all seem to travel together and one gets mad, the other ones come along for the ride. We seem to understand that the primary issue is just that the skin barrier is a little less tight than it would be. It's not really a disease, it's kind of a variation. And when the barrier is a little less tight, irritating things can get in there. water, scratchy soaps, scratchy wool sweater, various things in our life. And then the skin gets swollen and itchy and angry. We try our best to calm it down.
And we treat it with?
Definitely less is more for atopic dermatitis. I call it the baby test. Would you put it on a baby? Soft soap with your hands, nice pat dry, no need to scrub, moisturize. And if that's not enough, the topical steroids are the next pass. And there's some antihistamines for kind of the itch component. And there are some new biologics injections under the skin in the case that it gets real severe.
Would COVID hand, I say that, the hand washing of the last year has brought some people, and people who didn't wear gloves when they put Clorox on have very raw hands. Does that fall into this?
Very much so. It's that COVID hand, COVID overwashing has been, all of us just really stepped up our hand washing in the last year and a half. So a lot of irritated, cracky, dry skin, especially on the top of the hand. For that, my best pick is just trying to grease up your hands right before you go to bed. I have a little beeswax bar, I squish it on my hands. Whatever works for you, if you do it last thing, it'll kind of lock in while you sleep.
I keep something close by the sink. So after hand washing, I'll just take some hand lotion and rub it in, try to keep it from happening. Any other thoughts on eczema as far as where it can show up besides the hands?
It's kind of got its own evolution. So as babies, we'll see it in the diaper area and cheeks. For little kiddos, people often remember having it sort of on the inside of the elbows or the back of the knees. But what people might not notice is as adults, we get a whole new flavor. And that can be behind the ears and on the eyelids and the neck, the wrist, the hand, the top of the feet. And what's interesting is it's a really similar disease. It just shows up in a new place.
Where there's contact with glasses or other irritations, watches or...
Yeah, friction, folds, absolutely, yeah.
Herpes zoster, shingles, not too uncommon?
Shingles is a bear and it's sneaky, and I'll see it in young people as well. Just as it happened back in 2008 when the stock market got very strange, I was practicing in New York City and all of these 20-something young men were getting shingles on their face, on their trunk. And sometimes things as simple as really severe stress can wake this thing up.
And it's a virus, at least herpes zoster.
It is absolutely. It's this chickenpox virus that I had when I was a kid and you, and I think maybe the younger generation probably has a vaccine now. I think my daughter's not going to have the same chickenpox.
And then we activated stress or illness and times. Now, there's been a shingles vaccine and it's a 2-dose vaccine. Would you advise most patients that that's a good thing to get?
Yeah, the new vaccine is exciting because the old vaccine was a live, Merck had this OCA strain of vaccinia that you get in an inoculation. The new vaccine is actually killed, so it's not a truly active virus. So I think we can feel even better about the safety than we used to. And the studies show that even when people have had shingles when they're young, it's still helpful to get the shingles vaccine at 60. And the reason for that is that's going to protect us when we're 70, when we're 80, and help keep us from getting the severe and painful version of that.
Yeah, it's pretty devastating. Those painful lesions last. If somebody catches it and comes in, there's a remedy that you can do to try to shorten the course?
Definitely. The antivirals for shingles are very safe and well tolerated. You take a tablet 3 times a day for a week. And the goal is if we start early enough, we can prevent a lot of the pain and certainly prevent a lot of the long-term pain and nerve issues.
It's a little difficult to do an audio podcast on dermatologic issues, but they have a very characteristic presentation, kind of a long line of breakout along what we call a dermatome or a nerve root. So if someone's breaking out with painful lesions, particularly along a line, be suspicious that that's herpes zoster and get in right away.
Yeah, it's that combination, like you said, of these blisters, but the shooting pain that comes with the blisters that really gives us the clue that this isn't simply poison ivy or something else. It's really its own process.
And let's move to urticaria, hives. What happens there?
Hives are profoundly challenging. They are these swellings of the skin. The classic is if we get a bug bite and get a big swelling, but they can happen because of food allergies, because of things in the air, sometimes even just because, and they are itchy and really bothersome.
That's just wait it out and treat with topical anti-itch?
It's interesting. One of the reasons we know it's a hive is it goes away in less than a day. So creams aren't as helpful for this. This is where really the oral antihistamines do their best work. And for the daytime, I love the non-sedating, the Claritins, the Zyrtex, the Allegras, and their generic cousins. And then Benadryl, I like to save for nighttime because you don't need to be snowed all during the day.
Sunburn, we're coming into time of year. Let's talk a bit about that. We'll talk about degrees of sunburn, when should you be concerned, then we'll talk about prevention, and then consequences.
We Seattle people are famous for living kind of in the dark all winter, and then that first beautiful sunny day, we're so excited we come outside and we get a burn. So I think of sun kind of like that glass of wine with dinner. It's okay to get a little bit every day, but you don't want to stack up all your glasses of wine on a Saturday, and you don't want to have 8 hours of sun the first day of vacation.
You know, sunblock, what's the recommendation?
Yes, the sunblock game and numbers are going ever higher to the point where I think I've seen 110. And when I've tried them out, they feel real tacky. And I think that it's not necessarily clinically relevant. The next labeling is going to show, I think SPF is going to say 50. And I think over 50 is fine, but we don't know if it really matters, really has much of an impact. So I think anywhere between 30 and 50, you're golden. The ones that say waterproof are nice if you're getting splashing in the water. And then you want to make sure that it doesn't cause you to have any irritation.
How about the requirement for vitamin D through sun is after you've maybe used the heavier, you know, after that first sun, you're protecting yourself, but you're starting to develop a little bit of resistance to getting burned as you come along gradually. Is there a time, should you be out before you put on sunscreen or just put it on before you go out?
It's hard to say, because I think if we put it on perfectly, we'd be absolutely blocked from the sun. But I think in real life, we have kind of a variation of use and we do get some sun. Also, it does wear off. And I think real life use, throwing on a sweater, wiping our face, we're going to kind of end up with a little partial perfection. But yeah, if you were out for 5 or 10 minutes, I don't think lightning would strike you. And I think you'd be okay.
Penetration through clothing. I mean, there's UV resistant clothing now. So for very susceptible individuals who have to be concerned, where are we with that?
Those are my favorite. The standard out of Australia, but the concept is that the weave protects us and there's no chemicals. There's no reapplying. There's no question of whether it's going to rub off. They're perfectly predictable. I especially like it for little kiddos when their skin is still kind of maturing and their UV barrier is still coming in.
And the reason we're concerned about sunburn is, at least, I don't know if this is still true, but I was taught you do damage to the DNA of the skin.
Yeah, you know, UV is a class one carcinogen up there with smoking and chewing tobacco. And, you know, how much is a good amount? Probably a little is okay. But ideally, the UV, the part that actually damages the DNA, you may not need much at all.
So people say, well, I was out in the sun and I don't have any lesions. I was taught our DNA can repair itself when we're younger, but just as we age, that ability to repair fails, and then we start seeing the lesions that we probably developed as an exposure years ago.
Yeah, I'll see these teens who are perfectly healthy and they have these gorgeous brown tans and they look really well. Then I think people find after age 40, we start tanning in kind of a more speckly, splotchy way, and that's kind of the ghost of that damage we had before. So when people say, I want to look young forever, I want to keep my awesome complexion, I say, you want to wear SPF 30 face, neck, via chest kind of every day forever.
So appearance, dry, leathery skin, if you had heavy exposure. So if you want to keep your skin looking something other than a hide, protect yourself. And then prevention of skin cancers.
And vitamin D, it's really appealing, but I think especially coming times like the winter, vitamin D lasts about 90 days. So in the winter, it's going to kind of fade out, especially in places that have cold, dark winters. So short of like getting naked and laying on your deck in the cold weather of December, I don't think we're going to get enough UV from the ambient sun to really make it worth it.
There's a lot of guys who do a lot of outdoor work, whether they're weekend work and catching up on projects or it's their profession and they're out day in, day out. Areas that, you know, we want to make sure they cover behind the ears, in the ear, even lips and hat will protect their head.
Yes, I call those the forgotten areas, the top of the ear, the sides of the neck. And I think for gentlemen, especially men, the lower lip, because the sun comes straight at us and it's not common to wear a lot of chapstick.
For somebody who's laboring outside in direct sun, that UV resistant clothing probably is a good choice for them as well.
Just like you said, that broad hat, Australia has a lot of those hats with kind of the flapping backs to them, which do a similar job.
Well, let's go to a very common condition most men have experienced at some point, whether it was when they were in school in athletic activities or later in life, a jock itch. go through what that actually is.
Rashes on the groin are so common and so frustrating to people. Probably the most common cause is just that garden variety jock itch, which could come from foot fungus or toenail fungus, or just from bad luck walking on a surface. The good news, it's very treatable, and everything from the over-the-counter tenactin, the clotrimazole spray, all work really well. And then sometimes if it gets really severe, there's some prescription creams or even some tablets that can knock it down.
It's a fungus, and it thrives in a moist environment.
Where the skin folds, yes. The sweat's captured, the dead skin cells are captured, and the yeast and the fungus say, delicious, I want to hang out here. So we really want to cool off after we shower. Maybe that's just airing out for a bit. When you get sweaty, take off those dry fit layers. Those can get real swampy, I think, sometimes. And that way it won't get too moving in as we head to the hot summer months.
A lot of people would use a powder. There's been issues with talc recently. Some of the nurses who guided me through training said, oh, cornstarch is wonderful.
I'll tell you, everything old is new again. The cornstarch products are back in the stores under the classic labels that you've always seen. So I think it's really nice for absorbing moisture. There are some medicated powders. I think Gold Bond makes one of the antifungal powders. But I think some people find powders awesome to absorb. Some people find that they get a little bit kind of scrapey on their skin. Let your comfort guide you.
Severe cases where there's peeling, similar treatment?
That's a great question. So not everything in the groin is fungus. So if it stays peeling, people can have a little group B strep infection. There can be psoriasis in the groin. And these things aren't necessarily dangerous. But if you find that the antifungal is really not shaking it, it might be time to get a second set of eyes there.
What about rosacea? Explain what it is and common.
Yeah, rosacea is a cousin of acne, but it stays with us. And it's almost completely on the face. And I think particularly in folks who have fair skin, they'll see the red bumps and sometimes the flushing. And in kind of a more extreme case, the real bright red nose. And I think the problem is people assume they're heavy drinkers. That may not be the case at all.
If somebody comes in with rosacea, what do we do?
Yeah, so number one, we try to avoid anything that makes people more fleshy. So you say, hey, try to avoid bright UV sun. Some people, extremes of hot and cold, hot yoga, getting really fleshy can make it worse. Some people, it's alcohol or even sometimes just dark alcohols, like say whiskey instead of vodka, that can make them flush. We try to minimize those.
Are there treatments for it?
My dream is to get it as early as possible, nip it in the bud so it doesn't get crazy. And a lot of those treatments are topicals and even the same antibiotics we talk about for acne. Finally, if someone did have the thing progress to a real bright red nose or visible vessels on the cheeks, there's some really lovely targeted lasers that can attack it. One or two treatments. It's not the cheapest and it can be elective, but it really will get rid of that redness.
And going back to the theme beside COVID hand, there's a mask irritation. What is that that we're seeing?
The catchy phrase is mask me, and I've seen mask rosacea and mask yeast and mask irritation. We think it's probably the friction and the kind of the occlusion. Essentially, we're blocking our skin by sticking a mask, and as someone who wears a mask 8 hours a day, it really can get old. So we try to use a breathable fabric. We try to replace the mask, either wash it or throw it away, and try to the extent we can not put a lot of products under and not take it on and off all day if we can avoid that.
Yeah. You know, I think changing it, you know, in surgery, we would do 8 hour, 10 hour cases sometimes in the same mask. And that's about the limit that a mask is good for. But the mask is still preventing issues. So we don't want to do away with it, but we can get around it.
One thing good about masks, I found people are getting a lot less damage on their face last summer and they're touching their face less. So there's some small points of hope in there.
So you had some thoughts about aging and some of the dermatologic conditions. Go ahead.
Yeah, a lot of gentlemen, I think both in big cities and in general, are really conscious of looking young and energetic, particularly kind of in tech type jobs where there's certain expectation that people look a certain way. And unfortunately, that's spinning over to men as well. The good news is we want people to look their best and not age gracefully in a way that's very subtle. So there's a lot of choices for that. For men, I often hear them complaining about circles under the eyes. And I think it's a little more common in men just because they have strong expressions. And also because unlike gals, they're not going to use makeup to hide it. So they'll see it. when gentlemen have a little bit extra weight, they'll kind of notice some jowls and neck issues. And for guys that are quite thin, like active runners, they'll kind of notice hollows on their cheeks. And both of those things, happily, are kind of modifiable and fixable.
What do you do for the dark circles under the eyes?
For the dark circles, the first thing we want to do is minimize any sort of eye puffiness. So some people have a lot of salt in their diet, smoke salmon, chips. It'd be better to have less of that. Some things that make our eyes puff are things like ibuprofen. So if you're taking a lot of pain medications, we try to fine tune and drop that a little bit. But even if we do everything right, some people may still have either the blue color, and that's when the thin skin gets thin. For that, topical retin-A, topical vitamin A, topical retinols will help the skin plump a little. Other people, especially men, will have a little shadow, kind of where they have so prominent little, we call it the preceptal fat pad, and then this little shadow. And for those folks, either fillers to get rid of the shadow, or even the eye surgeons will take out that lower fat pad and keep things flat.
And aging, some changes of the lower extremity that people see?
Yeah, you know, as people get into their kind of 50s and beyond, our veins lose a little bit of their springiness and we can get some ankle swelling. The men will notice sometimes some visible veins and also some kind of rust color, which is blood under the skin, not dangerous, but usually part of swelling that we love to keep in check, both so your legs look great and also so you don't have red dots on you.
And remedies?
So we've got to make sure, again, with less salt and less puffiness, that does well for everybody. And also walking is the most important. Standing still and sitting still for long periods encourages our legs to swell. So if you sit at a desk, get that Fitbit that tells you to walk around every hour. Flex your calves, practice different ways to keep yourself strong. Try a standing desk. And that way our muscles will support those veins and keep them healthy.
If you do develop lower extremity edema, elevating your legs when you get home can help drain some of that.
Yeah. And I tell people just the level of the heart. You don't have to put them up in the sky or hang upside down like a bat unless you like to. But if you can kick them up on a coffee table or an ottoman, you're already doing a lot better for them.
They used to call them liver spots, but what is that?
Definitely. These are those brown spots that often come on the top of the hands that all of us don't appreciate because they make us look sometimes like our grandparents. And they're not at all dangerous. They're usually not a sign of anything, but they're usually a combination of sun damage, big freckles, sometimes some bruising, and a little loss of springing and elasticity. So our veins and skin gets a little more thin. Sometimes we can get bruises on the skin too, especially if we're doing a lot of stuff with our hands or we're taking a blood thinner.
And remedies for that?
If you're feeling fancy, if you're a hand model, there are some lasers to get rid of the brown color. There's even some fillers to plump up the hands, but thankfully I haven't seen a lot of gentlemen feeling the need for that. If the bruising starts happening, there's some supplements like vitamin C and rutin that can help soften some of that bruising.
And then some of the common conditions like psoriasis that you see that, you know, these plaques, go through that. What is psoriasis? Somebody's had it. What should they do?
Yeah, psoriasis, these thick, scaly areas, often on the knees, often on the elbows, often on the scalp, but it can be a lot of places, including on the trunk. It can be itchy, it's very visible, and it gets unfortunately and incorrectly assumed to be contagious sometimes. So we really like to treat it so people look their best and can do all the things they want to do, like swim with their kiddos or, you know, go to the beach. And also, we think that if we control it, it probably helps with keeping your heart healthy, things like that.
So go through some of the treatment strategies. What would you start with? What would you go to? What would be next?
Psoriasis, we think it's a little more angry with friction. So we try to avoid skin trauma if you can. If you're hiking a lot, wear those long sleeves. If you're hacking blackberries. But even when we do everything right, sometimes it comes at us pretty strong. The local treatments are safe as the day is long, but a little time consuming. Topical steroids, topical vitamin A, topical vitamin D, one or two times a day. If that's not enough, or you have a lot of areas, or it gets too time consuming, the next options are tablets, systemic treatments, light therapy, shining ultraviolet on just the psoriasis areas, and then finally these newer biologic medications.
And those are injectables?
They are. They're needles under the skin. They tend to be every week to every 90 days.
Ineffective?
They're really the most effective that we have. When you look at big studies, statistically, they are the most likely to clear, to make the skin almost completely clear of psoriasis. And that's exciting.
those are relatively new. So somebody hasn't visited treatment for a while, they should go in and see what's new.
Very much so, yeah.
Well, let's go a little bit to a common issue for guys, and then we'll jump back to skin, but pattern baldness and hair loss.
Absolutely. The hair and the nails are part of the skin, and so they're very near and dear to us dermatologists. And hair loss is so challenging. We may not always have the hair we had when we were 16, but we always want to have our best hair today. And the nice thing is there are more options coming up, even in the last 2, 3, 5 years that maybe people aren't aware of that they can try to keep their hair and even maybe regrow.
So male pattern baldness is usually familial or not? I mean, if you look in your lineage and people have gone bald, what do you expect?
Yes, it is. And there's a wise tale that if you look at your mom's father, that'll be the determining factor. But I've certainly met folks who follow that more or less. It can happen as early as people in their late teens and 20s, and for some folks, not till they're their 50s. But either way, people often see the hairline receding and that thinness right up at the crown.
And the hair on the top of the head that tends to be lost is the hair that's under the more influence of dihydrotestosterone, a breakdown product of testosterone.
Exactly. And this is right in the urologist world, and a lot of the same medications do a really nice job.
We do have another episode with some strong opinions, and they are opinions from urologists about the sexual side effects of one of those products that does block the dihydrotestosterone, particularly in young men. They're concerned about having a discussion. So, you know, to be fair to them, if you're heading towards male pattern baldness, you're considering one of these, have a discussion with the practitioner who's going to be prescribing it.
And maybe I can tell you about some of the other choices, just so you know that it's not, you know, a certain tablet or nothing. There's a really interesting study of identical twins out of Taiwan that said, hey, these male identical twins, how do we predict who kept their hair longer? And it turned out that the twins who didn't get sunburns on their heads, twins who didn't smoke, the twin who didn't have extra weight, wasn't overweight, and twins who didn't have diabetes kept more hair relative to those who did. So I'm not going to tell you that's a cure, but those are pretty easy things to stay on top of if you can.
Then going to the cosmetic issues to replace hair, where are we with?
Absolutely. So the first pass when people are starting to have that early hair loss, especially if they're bothered by it, are topical things. And what's kind of elegant is we can compound, you know, the classical Rogaine is minoxidil 5%, but we can bump up a higher 7%. And the finasteride, which is concerning as a tablet, we can also compound into a topical, hopefully just affecting the scalp. Other things that you might see for topicals are latanoprost, which is that Latisse. People use it for eyelashes, but guess what? It can do a nice job for scalps too. And all this stuff, usually we have to put it on about once a day to the scalp. So it can get a little sticky, but I think at bedtime, it's not too burdensome.
And do hair transplants work or have they come and gone? Do they stay or?
They are still there. The challenge is that everybody can continue to lose hair. So a hair transplant is part of a plan. It's not the solution. It takes the hairs from the back of our head, which can never miniaturize and shrink, and moves them to the areas where the hairs have shrunk. The limiting factor is we only have a certain number of hairs, certain number of deck chairs, as you were. And so if we take 2, 3, 5,000 and move them forward, we still have to keep the ones that we have. And there's a potential that men could lose more behind that hairline.
And looking at sort of consequences of, you know, total hair loss, that is a different issue. That's a disease called alopecia.
Yeah. And the word alopecia just means hair loss. People will say, do I have alopecia? And there's a lot of flavors. But that real common one that you may see of people with a very shiny head, no eyebrows, no eyelashes, is an autoimmune hair loss. And that's called alopecia areata.
And treatment now or no treatment? Or
it's better every day. So it's autoimmune. So we don't yet have that cure, but we can keep it quiet. And what's really exciting is there's this new class of medications called JAK inhibitors, and we can compound them topically to put them where the hair loss is happening. And in that way, we can hopefully wake up the hairs without impairing people's health.
Do we have any triggers for it or know why it happens? Or
about 1% of the population gets this. And a lot of people have one big episode during a very stressful time in their life, and then it can just go away, which is really nice. there's kind of another type that we see more often in kids where people will just lose all their hair. And that is a little more likely to be stubborn, maybe lifelong.
And then consequences of medication, chemo. What do you advise your chemo patients who lose hair?
There are all these technologies where you wear a sporty cap on your head and it tries to cool the hairs during chemo. There are some other sort of experimental physical modalities to keep the hair waking up. But the one other thing I want to touch on is for all of these treatments, kind of a more exciting and pretty safe new development is this platelet-rich plasma. We take the sample of blood, 4, 5, 6 tubes, spin it down to the plasma and actually re-inject the plasma into the scalp. Increases hair growth, increases hair density, increases the diameter of each hair. And that, you know, aside from the needles and the poking and perhaps the cost, it's very safe in terms of we're using our own bodies. We're not introducing chemicals. And I think that's appropriate for alopecia areata, men's hair loss, and other things.
And then let's talk about nails, since we put hair and nails together. Common disease of the nails, where they become opaque, and what happens there?
Nails are at risk for fungus, and particularly toenails, because they grow more slowly. And particularly our big toe, because it can take almost a year for that toe to completely regrow. So when I see a little bit of nail fungus, I love to be aggressive so people don't have to deal with all 10 nails having fungus.
And so topical treatment?
So simple things are topical, slow and steady. There's some lacquers, some drops, sprays, various things. And if that's not enough, or someone's in a hurry or has really dramatic, we're going to go for tablets.
Okay, so the oral route of the antifungal.
And there's a few choices, but all of them are broken down by the liver. So we try to time that treatment when people are not also in the middle of football season having a beer or are not, you know, taking a lot of Tylenol for a joint injury.
Okay. Well, let's move to the important aspect of the skin cancers going to common and then the devastating melanomas. And let's talk a little bit about each of them, prevention, screening, people with moles, mole screening, and treatments.
Skin cancer is the thing that keeps us dermatologists up at night. And of course, we wish they weren't happening, but they're in fact on the rise, probably just because of us living longer and enjoying the sun during that time. The ones that are locally troublesome with names like basal cell and squamous cell carcinoma, they can show up as early as age 30, especially for folks who grew up in, say, Southern California. But when they come, we try to get them as early as possible, treat them locally, and we just watch you like a hawk. People who are a little more risk for getting these are people who have a slow immune system, say kidney transplant type folks, and people who have autoimmune diseases that are taking pretty heavy duty medications for that, and certainly anybody undergoing cancer treatment.
Basal cells is, again, skin care, sun prevention. How about BIPOC populations, Black, Indigenous, people of color? They need to be careful as well?
Yeah, you know, and people who have skin pigment really ranges just depending on the individual, but someone who has dark skin can have an SPF of about 8, which is a great start. However, even that amount of pigment that's safe for being out in the sun for a day or two doesn't protect someone who chooses a profession. If you're a roofer, if you're outside, if you grew up in somewhere like the Caribbean and you get a lot of sun your whole life, those folks are equally at risk for things like squamous cell carcinoma, and especially for melanoma. We don't want to miss that.
Standard precautions, even if you have melanin, a slight amount or more, you still need to be careful.
Yeah, and a little melanin will make us be a little more forgiving. But I know living in Seattle, I'll talk to a lot of folks who've moved here from other places and they'll say, oh, I didn't know I could get a burn. But if we're really in cloudy places and lose our sun tolerance, we don't want to go get cooked on the first day of vacation.
So then going to moles and the progression of some moles to a more concerning carcinoma, when should people be concerned about a mole?
Yeah, so moles are a normal part of us and they appear from birth until probably our middle years, till we're about 35. And we watch them when they're symmetric, when they're all one color, when they're smaller than, say, a pencil eraser. Those are all reassuring features. What they should not do is change quickly, have multiple colors, black, purple, red. They shouldn't grow out little extensions, look like an amoeba or the coast of a strange island. And all those would be clues that they're changing in a way that's not healthy.
and important to get them early?
Because these melanomas can be devastating, the earlier we can get them, the better. Now, there's some new exciting immunotherapies that the survival rates are a lot better than they used to be. But of course, we'd never want anyone to have to get to that point.
So skin cancer screening, how do you advise it? How often?
Yeah, our U.S. Preventative Task Force recommendation, the kind of the official word, would say that everyone should get a head-to-toe check around age 60. In addition to that, we look at risk factors, blistering burns before you're 18, someone who was a lifeguard or lived by the water, had a pool, maybe used tanning beds back when. Other thing is having a first degree relative, and by that I mean a sibling or a parent or a kid or a child who's had a history of melanoma that increases in a way that we can't really modify. And finally, is having over 50 moles. So people who may just have a lot of moles is another thing that's a risk factor.
And going back to basal cells, can they metastasize?
I've probably seen two metastasize in 15 years. Thankfully, it's vanishingly rare, but if you ignore them long enough, they will in fact move towards the lymph nodes, invade locally into bone, things like that.
So part of the skin check, make sure you pick up any basal cells. And also we want to really be careful about picking up melanomas because they don't need to be very large to start sending cells out.
And one thing that's challenging, just for men, the most common place to get melanoma is the back. And it's just a challenging place to watch. So when partners, friends point out a mole, I just think that's a real gift to that friend.
And other skin lesions besides cancers that show up, we have some viral lesions. Why don't you go into those?
We all can get warts, from the kiddo warts on our hands and feet to skin warts on the face to even genital warts sometimes. All these warts are usually not troublesome as long as we get ahead of them quickly, but we like to treat them so they don't scar and they don't spread.
And lesions on the feet, you can get melanomas on your feet, even though you usually say you're wearing shoes, but, you know, exposure.
Yeah, it's kind of sneaky. Our palms and our soles, they can't tan. So if we get UV, let's say we fall asleep on a lounge chair on our stomach one day, that foot's going to get a lot of UV damage. So it's not common. If you see a brown spot on your foot, show it to your internist, show it to your podiatrist, show it to your derm, and we'll double check that thing.
Well, with our time left, let's talk about cosmetics in the sense of men who are seeking to perhaps rejuvenate skin. We talked about some need for lotions, but more aggressive treatment into even cosmetic surgery as people in the workplace want to continue to maintain a vitality. Talk a little bit about where we are.
There's a lot of interest. And for men, I think the two things people will sometimes comment is that it can be a challenge to have sort of heavy hooded eyelids or sometimes those kind of bags under the eyes. It gives the look of being tired, that even though we understand it's probably a familial thing, we probably got it because we look like our dads or whoever. For those, that's a great time for the eye surgeon to take that little bit of extra skin, lift things up just a little, and that can even be done under local anesthesia. That's pretty compelling because it's just quite safe. You're taking away the risk of being knocked out, less downtime. Another thing people notice, men and women both, but particularly men, is sometimes some laxity around the neck. And that can play out as jowls, that can play out as sort of a waddle. And particularly if people lose weight, they see, hey, I've got a fold under my neck. And I think it's universally unwelcome. For that, creams aren't going to lift the neck back up to where it was. So that's really where the plastic surgeon, the skin surgeon can take that extra skin and tighten everything up either behind the ears, sometimes under the chin, in a way that really restores that strong jaw.
And is there a role for Botox for guys?
Definitely. Guys actually need more Botox. And the reason why is really expressive, strong muscles of the forehead and around the eyelids. And that's where Botox can really help with crow's feet. The challenge is with having a broad forehead and strong muscles, we don't want to use so much Botox that it drops your eyebrows. So some folks will find they hit a limit to where they still have a wrinkle or two and they kind of let it be.
Botox typically lasts an injection for how long?
It'll start to kick in about a week from when we start the injection, and we enjoy it for sort of 3 to 4 to 6 months, depending on how strong the muscle is. So I tell people usually to plan on popping in about 3 times a year. It's a little bit time consuming to pop in, but the good news is each treatment is not terribly costly. There's no downtime. You walk in, walk out. And the goal for all of these is to look like yourself. My dream is that someone would say, you look relaxed, you look well. Did you get a haircut? Rather than, hey, did you do something? That's not helpful.
Excellent. Well, other cosmetic tips for guys?
Yeah, I think of our face as we age, which we all do, as sort of thinking about our favorite armchair. Sometimes we get some stains on the surface, and that's where lasers can chase out the color, the reds and the browns, and bring us even skin back. Sometimes we lose some stuffing. The full cheeks kind of slide downward towards the jowls, and that's where fillers can kind of restore volume and kind of bones that we need. Finally, there's things are just saggy, you need to reattach the fabric, and that's going to be the neck lift, things like that.
And other thoughts at this point for resources. We always like to give listeners an opportunity to find good information. So who would you send people to as far as dermatologic disorders? Let's start there with the things we talked about at the beginning. Where would you send somebody to find information about that, where they can find pictures?
Definitely. There are a couple of really lovely dermatology sites. And interestingly, DermNet New Zealand is one that is free and very accessible and written in a very crisp and clear way. I think if you Google a diagnosis, that usually comes up in one of the top lists. And finding a doc, the American Academy of Dermatology, the board certified dermatologist, is a nice place to search. Some folks also start with their insurance list.
Okay. And as far as looking at lesions and self-diagnosis, there's lots of, you can Google what you think, but the but is sometimes it helps having a professional take a look.
There are a lot of apps that try to offer a first pass and an opinion. They have names like MoleSafe or Spot Checker, and they're a reasonable try, but I think a lot of them are limited by how our photography works and the inability to turn a 3D structure like skin into a flat image.
Speaking of which, you just brought up, how are we doing with telemedicine and dermatology after, you know, this year? Telemedicine has exploded and it really is a great resource. How are you using it in the practice?
We've tried to offer a lot of telemedicine, but I find it's really best in our field for someone who already knows a diagnosis and we're managing, say, medications. If someone has a skin check, we haven't mastered holding their phone across their moles yet. A lot of times when COVID first happened, people would show us, I'd say, yep, that's a wart. Why don't we have you come in? So it was a little less efficient than I thought it would be. So I probably do about 10% of my time telehealth.
Better for follow-up after you've diagnosed what the lesion is, after you've done a full body check, and then as treatment's ongoing, you can monitor progress.
And I've certainly met very savvy younger folks who are really excellent photographers of their acne. And I think in that case, it can work nicely. But I think having an unknown is where photographs just aren't going to get us all the way where we want to go.
Other resources that you've had a chance to think about besides ones you've mentioned, anything else that you would suggest that people could find?
People often ask about whether sunscreens are safe. The Environmental Working Group does a database of sunscreens, spinning out ones that have chemicals that can be allergens or endocrine disruptors, so you can find one that fits what you want and is safe. I really like SPF clothing, sun protective layers. I just find to be so usable and safe and sustainable and probably one of the more effective things we have.
So in closing, it would be take care of your skin, avoid excessive sun exposure, use sunscreen, clothing where appropriate. If a lesion develops, see somebody.
I like that. Yes.
Well, Dr. Kendra Bergstrom, thank you so much. It's been enlightening. Again, your primary care doc, your pediatrician if you're young, your internist, dermatologist would all be good resources. And probably plastic surgeons are versed in a lot of this as well.
We're all on the same team, and so don't be shy to show it to that first doc that you have a good relationship with, and they can help triage you and see what the next step might be.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Good talking today.
This completes another episode of the Original Guide to Men's Health podcast. We wish to thank all guests who volunteered their time and knowledge. The information presented is the opinion of the speakers. The show's recordings are engineered and edited by Sean Fox. Episode titles and descriptions, as well as editing assistance, are provided by Dr. Kathleen O'Connor, PhD. Music for our show is San Juan Bells, written and performed by Dr. David Weidig. The podcast is sponsored and published by the Washington State Urology Society. The Original Guide to Men's Health is an original publication of the Washington State Urology Society. Reproduction and use without the expressed or written consent of the Society is prohibited. For more information about men's health and previous episodes, as well as additional recommended resources, visit us online at theoriginalguidetomenshealth.com. This is Dr. Richard Pellman thanking you for listening and reminding you to take care of yourself.